Digital 410 proudly presents the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast with your hosts, Don Abernathy, Jeff Copsetta, and Henry Sledge.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, your favorite World War II based podcast. And we are here for another fun, exciting night of world travel and tale of all kinds of fun and excitement. Joining us, as always, Mr. Henry Sledge. Henry, how are you doing today, sir?
I'm doing well. Doing well. Happy to be here.
Happy to have you. And joining us, as always, from the great big-ass state of Texas, Mr. Jeff Copsetta. Jeff, how are you doing today, sir?
Yeah, I wouldn't say as always. I feel like
I didn't want to make you feel bad. Henry, I didn't want to point out the obvious to everybody and embarrassing in front of our guests. But anywho, joining us from the great white north, you know him from the HBO Pacific. You know him from his appearances on the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, Mr. Scott Gibson. Scott, how are you doing today, sir?
Very good, eh?
Eh?
Hey.
And the award for the best camera of the night makes all of ours look like we're rocking webcams from 2004. Great job on the technology, sir. You must be rocking an iPad.
It's what an actor has to do, right?
Yep, gotta look good, gotta look good. So
that's all it is. Teeth and hair, Don.
That's the key components. Both things that need a good insurance policy. Unless you're a lady, then you got to go with the legs. Interesting fun fact, prior to the hurricane, my roof got reinsured by the same people that insured probably your hair and teeth, the Lloyds of London. So they came through with my insurance payments on my roof, much like they do the actresses' legs who insure them for millions of dollars. Before we get into your goings on, we kind of tease people that Jeff is going to do this from time to time, and we don't do it. And I'd like to throw curveballs to Jeff to see him, like, shaking his chair, wondering what the hell. Jeff, give a brief synopsis, a little brief, breakdown of your latest model project. It's not exactly World War II, but we're going back to the precursor, World War I. The pilot who's named after the frozen pizza and after Snoopy's character, the one and only Red Baron.
Man, yeah, that is a curveball, because I could have had it sitting here waiting for that.
Should, would have, could have, but...
like I've said on the show before, and with conversations with you guys, it's really hard to understand the Second World War if you don't quite get the First World War. And it took me a long time to really kind of figure that out. And, it's important for those who just strictly stick to World War II, I get it, because there's so much we want to read, right? There's so much out there. There's so much to know about the Second World War that, you don't want to stray. But I went down that rabbit hole and I've enjoyed it because it's put so much into perspective. So yeah, as you guys know, I like to do a little historical history through modeling, I guess you could say, because I don't want to say I still build model airplanes, because that's for Scott's like, yeah, that's for dorks.
Hey, we live say in it. I don't want to alienate half our audience here, but we do live in a time where it's perfectly acceptable for 43-year-old dudes to go to Comic-Con dressed up like it was their favorite comic book character. So there's absolutely nothing wrong with you and your son spending quality time putting together a 1/1/1/1/1/1/1/1 scale of a canvas airplane. Tri-wing, correct?
I built his triplane, the famous red DR-1, Fokker DR-1, or the British called them tripes. And it was Germany's answer to the Sopwith triplane. We were the first ones, the Allies were the first ones to have a three plane, triple winger, I guess you could say. So that became just the infamous, like you said, the Red Baron pizza and Snoopy and the Red Baron. It just was like the most famous aircraft that came out of the First World War. And interestingly enough, building this model, doing the research that I do, there's still debate today, 105 years after von Richthofen was shot down, as to what color the underside of his aircraft was. Everybody's just assumed it's all red. And there's a good chance it wasn't. Most experts say that the underside was that light blue, German aircraft underside blue. So that's the scheme I went with, red on top and that pale blue on the bottom, because that's what the experts say. But it's interesting now, we still can't even solve that. We still don't even know. There's some Canadian pilot, right? Some Canuck we give credit to, right? Roy Brown. we give him credit to shooting him down, but it could have been, you know, a rifleman on the ground. So
two things. This leads to one of my questions I had when you're talking about people tend to have a more interest in World War II opposed to World War I, unless they're longtime historians, which my first question would be, do you think a lack of source material would be for that reason, which would then also include his follow-up? We're arguing over the color of the bottom of his plane because of lack of source material, because of, you know, the infancy of black-white photography at the time.
Yeah, that's a good point. There's no color photos, so people are really having to dive deep into the shading, and is there a change? Does it look like it's different from the red? And on and on, and it's stuff that just makes people's eyes bleed and nobody really cares about it anyway. So just make your best, you know, guess and try to keep history alive and have fun with it.
What was the technological reason for the tri-wing? Did they think it was more maneuverable? Did it have better lift with a heavier engine? What was the actual technical reason for going with the tri-wing?
Yeah, that's actually a really complicated question. I don't want to waste too much time on it, but yes, for a short answer, yes, it was very maneuverable. Had a very short, stubby wingspan. It was a very small aircraft, and I didn't realize how small it was till I put it next to the other ones that I had built. You know, I built a Fokker D7, a SPAD 13, and a Sopwith Camel, and the triplane was just minuscule compared to those. And yeah, I guess. But the control surfaces were only on the top plane, you know. The other two were just, and there's no dihedral to them. So, again, it's those things when you think about the technology in 1917 when they first debuted to what we were using not that long into the future, you know, Battle of Britain, for example. So all of those things, you know, all the pieces fall together, all the dominoes from the First World War to lead us to the Second. And it's interesting to learn about.
Absolutely. And thank you for sharing the photos. And we will also include those, as always, at WTSPWorldWar2.com. But without any further ado, Mr. Scott Gibson, let me ask you a question. When you signed on to do the series, obviously you had a little bit of a hint from what the actors from Band of Brothers had done. But did you ever anticipate that World War II would have such an influence or a grasp on your life after the production?
No.
Short and sweet.
At the time being cast and doing that, you're just so wrapped up in, I don't want to fuck this up. And what are they going to do to me over there? And do I really have to do boot camp? And it's Spielberg and Hanks.
Yeah. And I guess the pressure of portraying a real life person opposed to a fictional character has got to be that much more pressure on you.
A lot of pressure. And this is a story that's out there now. I don't, you know, name names, but the actor who was supposed to play John Bassalone was fired on his first day of boot camp. You know, they just made a choice, brought John Seda, and just didn't work out. So this guy hadn't even been on screen yet, and he got fired. And these things happen that, you know, obviously not a lot of people know about, but we all felt like, holy shit, if this can happen. So you just wanted to get on screen as quickly as possible on camera, and you're done.
Let's make it more expensive for them to fire me. Tape. We don't want to do reshoots.
They still had to pay him. But you know, subsequently over the years, it's just become bigger and bigger. More people interested, more fans, younger fans. And as a result, it's unlike anything else in terms of being a celebrity, is the fact that you are representing, you know, someone who fought in the Pacific and European, and it's so incredibly humbling, for one, so much gratitude for it. But also that you're able to get that person's name out there. People understand that story. They watch the series, they read the books. At the time I thought I'd do the series and then, maybe I get another series, right? As an actor, you think this will propel me into something else, and whether that happens or not, but none of that really matters. I mean, like, this is, you know, the greatest thing I've ever done. And for a lot of guys, the same thing. It's just, you do a lot of stuff that really isn't that important. It's entertaining, et cetera, and so forth. But to do this, and even in Normandy, when I go to Normandy, people that recognize me for that role is just incredible.
Well, and that's kind of what I was getting to with my first question about, did you ever anticipate having the World War II having this much more impact on your life? Because it's been several years since the series, and as we're having you on to explain and give us a rundown, you just returned from a trip overseas that had to do with the topic of World War II, and that's kind of why I was wondering. It's like, I bet he never really anticipated things going this far, but for those who aren't familiar with your social media pages and your adventures, give us our audience a little rundown of the trip you just took.
I met this group. So I was there last year with Tim Gray and the World War II Foundation. And on that trip, I met Jeff Wells with his group, which is Wishes for Heroes, for our heroes. They raise money for active serving duty military in the U.S. So anyone with whatever sort of issue, they raise money, and they have these gala events. So I went to one in San Antonio, I went to one in Milwaukee, and then they were coming back for their second year in Normandy. They rented a chateau, Ile Saint Marie, which is on the property of, I think, around 1300 William the Conqueror. There's Viking wall establishment there, but the current family, I guess they can trace their history back there about 300 years. And his new group, new charity is Walk Among Heroes. So they bring veterans to Normandy. There's not very many of them left, but we were there this year with Reed Clanton, who will be 99 in August. And he was with the 84th Infantry, 29th Division. He landed on Omaha Beach. And the other veteran was James Kelly with the 6th Airborne. I think the regiment was the Dublin Rifles, if I get that exact. But he landed D-Day as well. So just a tremendous and very different experience to be there with these guys, because they are so much recognized as heroes there by all the people in Normandy or anyone that goes there. And it just to walk where they walked and to get glean any kind of information or stories from them is just incredible, you know.
I see you also had the privilege of meeting Mr. Jake Larson.
Yes. Yeah, that was our first day at Omaha Beach. We went there, I think it was June 2nd, right at around 6:30 in the morning. So we had a very good visual of what it would have been like at that time with the tide out, the wind and the cold and everything. And we went down to the beach and then went to this restaurant, and Jake was in there. Just sort of, you know, coincidence off was he was with a bigger group, but for some reason he got in there, and he's 100 and I think he's 101.
I think so.
And he could not stop talking about or expressing his gratitude for being alive, because he said his Higgins boat landed. And the only thing that basically saved his life on Omaha was he was able to get to this berm quickly. And he said everyone else was dead. Like, dead. Gone. And he was behind that berm for a while and obviously, you know, made it out of there. But he said he was like, why, you know, why me? Why me? Like, why? Why did I survive? And I'm so grateful. And he was the happiest, most beautiful man. And I guess if you make it to that point and you survive that, then obviously if you reflect back, that's what you would say, I would think. But he just, you know, how lucky am I? He kept saying that.
And he's sharp as a tack. I've had him on the show twice. And I saw his videos back in, near the end of the pandemic on TikTok. His granddaughter was putting up one videos. I reached out to him. And he came on, and up till the show, you know, you're like, okay, this guy does 1 minute podcast. One minute TikTok. How cognitive is this guy? I mean, he seems pretty on point. And so when you interview vets, you really don't know if you're going to have to pull a lot of information out of them, if you're going to have to kind of go back and edit and put the show together. He is the epitome of brain as sharp as a tack, regardless of what his body's doing. He went for 200 minutes straight and still wasn't done. I had to follow him. We actually had him on for two consecutive episodes because he is so sharp and he has so much information. And as you said, he's so happy and jovial. And he just he's just one of those guys, you just pull that string and you just step back, cross your arms, and just let him go. He is so sharp.
There were these kids that came in. I mean, these girls had to have been, 8, 9 years old, French family. And I think he'd met them earlier on in the trip, or maybe the previous year, I'm not sure. They brought him artwork. You've never seen love like he expressed to them and them to him. And because in France, or, you know, particularly in Normandy, I mean, these kids they know more about the war than, you know, people do here.
Mm-hmm.
And the love that they expressed to him was just like, just so beautiful, so beautiful to see and witness. And there was, you know, obviously a lot of that around the whole time that we were there. And the ladies loved him.
Oh, absolutely.
He's a stud, and all of them are just, I have a hard time talking to them just because I'm like, I have no idea what to say to you.
He's the type of person, like, God willing, if I live to be that age, I hope I have his personality, his wherewithal, and he's on the ball. And he knows what he, you know, much like a lot of other veterans, you know, post-war and through the 60s and 70s, they just kind of kept themselves, even through the 80s and 90s. And later in life, as you look around, you see more and more people are passing away, and you see there's more and more renewed interest in original news stories that haven't been told. You know, through his granddaughter and 1 minute TikToks at the time, he just started telling these 1 little minute stories, and they're so interesting. Like, he told the story on the show about the gentleman at the on the beach who took the hit instead of him, and all the others. There's just so many great stories. And like we did last week, we'll post a link to his two episodes along on the episode for this particular episode. But if you guys haven't heard that episode, two episodes, go back and listen to Jake. He just goes and goes. And then he surprised me, sent me a postcard in the mail with his photo from overseas, plus some of his more modern day photos. I actually have his postcard hanging up here in the podcast studio.
He's planning to be back for the 80th.
It's good to have goals. Got to have reason to get up in the morning.
Right.
And that far ahead, it's and that's got to be, I mean, that's a long flight, right?
Yeah. Well, the Jim, he was over there, and the British guy, he flew over in a glider on D-Day.
Yeah.
And bringing him over there, the people, one of Jeff's people in England, London, talking to Jim, saying, do you want someone to meet you at the airport and bring you over there? And typical English guy's like, well, you know, the last time I flew over there was in a glider, so I'll be all right.
Fantastic.
I landed in the glider, so I'll be fine. And this guy was spry. He's turning 97. He works out 3 days a week. I said, what's your secret to your health? He says, Scott, I eat cornflakes every day. You know, just so British. But and he plans to be back there. And I think there was a group sponsored by Delta Airlines that brought about 45, 50 veterans from the U.S. And next year, I think American Airlines is doing it.
While you were over there, did you guys primarily show up to public speaking events, or did you get to do any battlefield tours?
No, we did. We did Omaha, Utah. The thing that left me, or, you know, upon reflection coming back, was that along that Atlantic wall, there were 8,000 bunkers built. 8,000, which is incredible. And on D-Day, they were unscathed. The bombings barely hit. And if they did hit, it didn't do much. So, you know, maybe if they had done, you know, if the landing was at night, et cetera, and so forth. But, and the conflict between Rundstedt and Rommel, because Rundstedt was in charge and Rommel was brought in to just deal with those landings. And I think it was Rommel that wanted the Panzers to be moved in.
Yeah.
And Rundstedt didn't. And it was like, well, let's let them come inland and then we'll get them. And then the other guy's going, well, no, we'll hit them when they land. And you think, man, if that Panzer division was there, it might have been game over.
Well, a lot of that had to do with the subterfuge on our behalf with the Ghost Division and all the purpose-fed intel, quote-unquote, through the French resistance about, oh, they're going to land up north. So they really didn't. They had, you know, a lot of them speculating, no, it's going to be down here. The intel was saying up north. And so they kind of were trying to argue over where to position the Panzers. Okay, we're kind of put a little further north. So if they do go north, we can get up there. If they're going to go south. And so a lot of that, thankfully, had to do with the subterfuge and the bad intelligence that we purposely fed to them through the French resistance.
When you're there in one of those bunkers on the beach, that's, I mean, it looks like it probably did back on D-Day. And the only, you know, one of the bigger ones we were in, there was a Navy shell that clipped the top of the bunker, and then it hit where they're ammunition was, and you could see the holes, but virtually the whole thing is still intact. And that was one that had an 88 in it. And you just think of these guys hitting the beach. I mean, it was a turkey shoot, right? For, you know, Charles Shea, the medic, Native American medic, and he's got a monument there, and we went to his ceremony. And he was talking about when he landed there on Omaha, and rescuing guys, but he got up to the berm and he looked back and he figured there were about 200 guys dead, you know. So all that is just so, I mean, you read about it and, you know, you talk to people, but when you go there and you really put it into perspective, it's really, really profound.
Yeah, I was thinking, you're probably standing in this bunker, and we've seen the photos, we've seen the recreations in the movies, but when you're standing there and you're, I'm sure there's a lot of people talking, but if there was a moment of quiet, you probably could figure how eerie it would be to be the German in that bunker on quote unquote guard duty. And you have the sound of the ocean, the smells coming through, the dampness in the bunker. And then all of a sudden, as the light comes up, you just see it in front of you. Like, yeah, it's about to get real.
What must they have seen?
Yeah.
Right. Like, just, I mean, it, you know, the bombings are over, and then you're like, okay, and then you wake up at 6, you know, whatever, 6:30 in the morning, and you see all that. It would just be, it's so hard to put into perspective. I you know, even for some of these guys, I hesitate to even ask them, you know, Reed or James, any sort of personal story, any kind of nitty gritty about a day, because I think it must be just so hard for them, really.
Yeah, you know, and the experience I've had of interviewing a handful of vets and a few I've talked to off the air, my whole thing is I try to talk to them about the daily lives of soldiering, whether it's, you know, here, I don't bring up the combat so much. And then as the story progresses, if they bring it up and start talking about it, then I'll kind of follow up. But yeah, I'm like you, I don't just dive into the nitty and the gritty of it. Jeff actually gave me the book version of The Longest Day, and in the early chapters, a very cool description of one of the German commander is pulling down. They give a beautiful description, pulling down a nondiscreet road. He gets out. There's a little cobblestone path that goes, curves around in the woods and goes down along the edge of this cliff. And it's very descriptive. And it was just, that was the entrance path to one of those bunkers you're talking about. It's like, they weren't some big grandiose thing. It was just, you pulled over in this little pinewood area, got off, walked down this cobblestone. You try not to fall down the cliff because it has a little cable, and boom, next thing you know, you're walking through concrete doors and you're in these bunkers.
And the other thing, I mean, the movies couldn't really, any of the movies couldn't really do this. But so much of inland was flooded.
Yeah.
So 101st, 82nd, and I guess not so much the British. They maintained, I think, hitting their targets, but guys land in 5 feet of water and drowned because of all the equipment. You know, in order to secure those bridges, the great stories, the Filthy 13, that those engineers that secured some bridges, Pegasus Bridge,
mm-hmm.
the British took that in about 10 minutes because they landed so close with their gliders. I don't know exactly know where Jim landed, but this town that they went to take, and I forget the name of it, but they were getting bombarded from artillery from Canadians. So a major swam across these two rivers, connected with the Canadians, said, "Hey, you know, you're gonna level us and kill everybody in this town." And so they stopped. But someone had asked him, you know, "Oh, what was it like to be under friendly fire?" And Jim again just, "Well, I didn't find it that friendly."
Yeah, right.
You know, and that's all he has to say about it. But we went to the monument to his battalion in this little town, and he just stood there in front of it for the longest time. And Jeff was just starting to ask him, like, "How do you feel?" or anything. And Jim didn't say a word, not a word, because it just, you could see it brought him right back. And this is, you know, this little village, and it's someone's backyard, kind of on the road where the monument is. So really, really moving and profound. Like, so I just feel so fortunate to be able to have gone there with those guys.
Jeff, you got any follow-ups?
Man, yeah, I just love hearing it, because Scott and I, we've talked quite a bit, you know, since he's been back, and just hearing these stories, it's just man, I can't wait to go, because, you know, it just made me think when you said walk where they walked, you know, just the other day, you guys may have saw, I posted a little today in history about, you know, when General Custer and five companies were wiped out the Little Bighorn. And, I remember walking that battlefield and just that eerie, you know, I didn't get it so much at Gettysburg, probably because I was just a little too young when I was at Gettysburg, but being at the Little Bighorn, and just seeing, just every now and then, you know, just tall grass, every now and then, just a headstone that says unknown, you know, not even headstones, crosses, you know, just those reminders of what was done there. So I can only imagine. I've never really stepped foot, you know, recently. Of course, I don't know how many people fought and died over the city of Baghdad, right? You know, millions through the ages. So I don't even know the history. I probably walked right through there and had better other things to worry about. But yeah, I couldn't imagine, Scott, especially somebody like you who have really, you know, delved into the subject, have made an emotional attachment to it, you know, in your portrayals, to have that kind of understanding and then to be there. You know, I couldn't imagine, because this is not necessarily just a crime scene. It's just massive amounts of life that were snuffed out on both sides. Just so many humans taken out. It's just
to see the local people. Like, we stopped at Lafayette Bridge, and we'd met with Helen Patton, who's granddaughter of George S., and she had invited us to her place, is right beside Lafayette Bridge. And so we got out and doing a little talk. Jeff was talking about what happened, and there was this young kid. I mean, this guy was early 20s, and he stood there for 20 minutes with his girlfriend. I don't